from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the program, Amigos de las Americas. It's a nonprofit that sends young people to volunteer on community projects in Latin America. We'll meet two of the young people who are going to be going off this summer. Also, Dead Lucky. It's a memoir of being left for dead near the top of Mount Everest. But first, now that the California Supreme Court has struck down the state's ban on same-sex marriage, what's next? Will gay couples be getting married soon? Is there any room for opponents to appeal? And what about the proposed constitutional amendment that could be on the November ballot that would limit marriage to a man and a woman? Big topics to discuss. We've got several people lined up, both in our studio and on the phone. We'll start with Ellen Pontac, a woman from Davis. She and her partner, Shelley Bales, were married in San Francisco in 2004 during that brief window when they could do that. Their marriage was invalidated later that year by the California Supreme Court. Ellen, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
How did you and Shelley react? How did you feel when you heard that the California Supreme Court had struck down the ban on same-sex marriages?
Well, evidently, Shelley started to cry and I just smiled like a fool. It's just the most wonderful thing. It's just so right.
Had you expected it?
Actually, yes. As soon as I refused to think about it until we got there. And then as soon as I got on the court steps, I just felt like we had run. We had won already. I was just really grinning from ear to ear. And then, of course, when the news really came out, it was just wonderful.
Are you and Shelley planning to remarry?
Oh, absolutely. Not remarry, truly marry. We are going to marry as soon as we can, and then we plan to have a big celebration and really invite all of our community that's been so supportive and so happy. Everyone wants to rejoice in some way, so that's what we're going to do, is just create an opportunity.
Okay. In our studio is someone who has a different perspective on same-sex marriage. He's Craig Deleuze. He's a husband and father of two who says marriage should only be between a man and a woman. Craig, welcome to Insight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how did you respond when you heard about the California Supreme Court ruling?
Quite frankly, I was shocked and I was disappointed. There were on many, many different levels. First of all, as an African American, it really bothered me and quite frankly appalled me that sexual preference was put on par with the experience that African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans have gone through.
Because the majority court ruling drew from its previous ruling allowing people of different races and ethnicities to get married.
Well, and no, actually not, because in actuality, those previous rulings had to do with a redefinition of marriage. In other words, they were trying to keep marriage from becoming, previously it was marriage between a man and a woman. They wanted to make it a man and a woman of the same race. This is another attempt to redefine marriage. And quite frankly, it bothered me because, you know, I'm trying to raise my children with an understanding of the value of the family of a mother and a father and the important roles that a mother and father play in the role of a family. And for my government our courts to undermine that, I think really speaks ill of our justice system as well as our legal system.
But why do you think it would undermine your own family if two women or two men elsewhere were to get married?
Well, as the courts have ruled in the past that one of the primary interests that the government has in regulating or promoting marriage has to do with procreation, creating the most positive environment to have and raise children. And study after study has shown that is in a two-parent mother and father household. That is how I want to raise my children. And I've got a system, whether it's an educational system and now a court system, telling me that I'm educating my children incorrectly. They are, in fact, legislating their morality upon us.
Craig Deleuze, also in our studio, is law professor Larry Levine. He teaches at McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. His expertise includes sexual orientation and the law. Larry, welcome to Insight.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Were you surprised by the California Supreme Court's ruling?
I wasn't very surprised, to be honest, because the issue before the court was really a very narrow one. In California, we have had existing as the law domestic partnerships which provided virtually all of the benefits of marriage to registered domestic partners. So the issue before the court was simply whether we could have two, in essence, separate but equal regimes. And the court, looking at the state constitution, concluded that it was inappropriate and unacceptable to draw that distinction.
Craig?
I would agree with him. That was the state. That was the thing that was before the court. The reality was the California legislature were the ones who passed domestic partnership and then gave it all the same rights and benefits. They didn't, and when they did it, they didn't say, okay, these are the rights and benefits. Specifically, AB 205 said, domestic partners, if you want to know what your rights are, look to those of spouses. That flies in the face of Proposition 22. And because
Proposition... That was a proposition in 2000 that voters approved, which banned same-sex marriage.
Correct. And because that was Proposition 22 was an initiative, if you're going to create a substitute, if you're going to amend it, you have to go back to a vote of the people. The legislature never did that. And because of that, they created this counterfeit marriage, which was now used as the basis to approve same-sex marriage.
Ellen Pontag, what do you feel about domestic partnerships?
Well, we were domestic partners. And still are, and it was an important step, but it's not marriage. It's just separate and unequal, and certainly separate and less. I did want to ask Craig though, if he were gay, I think he would feel differently right now. It's hard to imagine that, I suppose, but
okay. Well, let's put it to him.
Well, first of all, I'm not gay. If I were, I'm not going to say that I would not feel differently because I'm not, and it's a little hard for me to walk in your shoes. But I will say that what I know and I understand are the values that I was raised with, that my family was raised with, and how important it is to me to be able to maintain those values without big brother government trying to force some values, moral values upon us. And that's my biggest concern is that you've got the courts, first the legislature, now the courts, enforcing their values upon us.
Larry?
Craig's criticism of the generous domestic partnership benefits in California notwithstanding, an effort was made by those who oppose marriage equality to put on the ballot something that would undo our domestic partnerships, and they couldn't even get enough signatures to qualify that for the ballot. So really, I think it is accurate to say that the debate was about the word, the name of marriage, and who has ownership of that term.
We're talking today about the repercussions of the recent ruling by the California Supreme Court, which struck down California's ban on same-sex marriage. You've already heard from three of our guests on the phone. Ellen Pontag, a Davis woman. She and her partner, Shelley Bales, were married in San Francisco in 2004. The marriage was invalidated later that year by the same California Supreme Court. In our studio, Craig Deleuze, who is opposed to redefining marriage as anything other than between a man and a woman. Also, Larry Levine, a law professor at McGeorge School of Law. His expertise includes sexual orientation and the law. Next, Randy Thomason, president of the Campaign for Children and Families. Randy, welcome back to Insight.
Jeffrey, a pleasure to be with you. Hi, everyone.
When the ruling came out, you were quoted by your organization as saying that the Supreme Court had, quote, destroyed the civil institution of marriage between a man and a woman. How could that be?
Well, there's a religious institution, and then there's a civil institution. As the professor knows, a civil institution is what the government creates. So the civil institution of marriage is government's recognition of marriage. That's why marriage has been only for a man and a woman since the beginning of the state. And that was redefined, thus destroyed. The judges shredded the definition of marriage and now is going to impose their radical agenda upon the rest of the state. I have to tell you, Jeffrey, I felt worse about being a citizen on the day that it came down because I know my Constitution, and the Constitution says that there's only the two legislative powers in the state, the legislature and the people through the initiative process. The California Constitution actually says in Article 3, Section 3, that the judiciary cannot exercise the powers of the legislature. And so I was going, if they can tear up the vote of the people, if they can redefine this very foundational institution of marriage and create a whole new role model for children, I wonder what they can't do. And I felt very bad about that as a citizen who believes in democracy.
Okay. Larry Levine, let's pick up on that issue. Did the court overreach in coming to this conclusion?
I actually don't think they did. I think that
some of the justices thought they did.
Indeed, some did. And I think they all struggled with this. And I'm even willing to say I think all of the justices really wished this controversial issue would never have come before them, because they know it's an issue on which people have very strong feelings on all sides. But at the end of the day, the court had to do its job. And when we're dealing with constitutional interpretation, it is their responsibility to look at the issue before them and to see whether such a thing as prohibiting access to marriage by same-sex couples passes constitutional muster.
Let's bring in our final guest. Jim Carroll is managing director of Equality California, which is a group working on several gay, lesbian-related issues, including the marriage issue. Jim Carroll, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking about some of the basic issues already, so I want to put something specific to you. I heard on the radio a few days ago a man who identified himself as gay who said he was concerned, he was worried about the Supreme Court ruling, because he said that there'd been slow but steady progress towards domestic partnerships and legal equality without a lot of backlash in society. But whenever gay marriage becomes the story, there's a big backlash. And he was worried that the rights of gay people could be set back by something like this. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I think so many of us were just thrilled by the court's decision, and it was a victory for all Californians who cherish fairness and the opportunity to marry. So I don't think reaching for equality is overreaching.
What's your understanding of what happens next? When do you think same-sex couples could get married in California?
Our best guess would be that by June 16th, same-sex couples could start getting married.
June 16th?
Yep.
We've got a terrible line with you, Jim. I believe that our control room is going to work on improving that. So, well, let's put this to Larry Levine. As a law professor, what do you make of this? When do you think marriages could happen?
30 days from a week ago today, I think there will be marriages. I know there are some efforts afoot to stop the process or slow the process down, but I am virtually certain that we will have same-sex couples married in California quite soon, whether people are happy about that or not.
By the way, we touched base today and yesterday with two local clerk recorder offices and also the state's Office of Vital Records to get some idea from them about what's likely to happen next, but they all said some variation on it's too soon. Craig Deleuze?
Now, I understand that the court actually can stay their opinion, at least pending the outcome of the constitutional amendment, which is going to be on the ballot in November.
I thought it was still waiting for the signatures to be verified.
Well, the signatures are going to be verified, but with 1.1 million signatures, I'm pretty confident it's going to be verified.
In all likelihood,
I mean,
yes.
Let's think of the chaos that would ensue if you have people getting married, and then in November it's overruled, and now all of a sudden, what do you do with those people who've been married? I mean, legally, what is going to be the consequences of that? And this, it wouldn't be the first time that the court did it. They did it when they approved parental consent back in 1996, and then overturned it a year later. But they stayed their decision.
Larry, do you think that could happen?
I'd be shocked, because it's not like this is a sudden issue foisted on the Supreme Court of California. They know this has been working its way toward them for a very long time, and the justices struggled mightily. The Chief Justice, who wrote the opinion, recently said this was the most challenging decision of his tenure on the court. So the court didn't reach this decision quickly or without great thought, and I would be shocked if they decided to put it on hold.
Do you think, Larry, that the justices would have had in the back of their mind, or the front of their mind, that there was a proposed constitutional amendment working its way through the system, and in a few months' time, the people of California might well say yes or no to defining or redefining marriage?
Well, one of the justices, Justice Corrigan, in her dissent, specifically raised the idea that, as others have mentioned as well, that we should let this percolate through the political process, and her point was that there is increasing acceptance of marriage equality, and we should just let that unfold at its own pace. My response to that is that the job of the court was to resolve the issue before it, and it really, frankly, would have been the political act of deferring and not acting under the circumstances of the case.
Randy Thomason of the Campaign for Children and Families, let's get back to this proposed constitutional amendment that will almost certainly be on the ballot in November. What do you think the chances are that the voters will vote for it? In other words, change the Constitution so that it states explicitly that marriage could only be between a man and a woman?
Because same-sex marriages would be happening throughout this summer, that alone is going to motivate millions of Californians to vote yes for the Marriage Protection Act.
Couldn't it work the other way, too, though?
No, I don't think so. When you look at what happened with Gavin Newsom in 2004, the mayor of San Francisco, he broke the law, created over 4,000 same-sex marriages, altered the certificates. You saw marriage amendments pass around the country. In response, the Los Angeles Times actually did a poll, found that opposition to same-sex marriage had increased to two-thirds of Californians at that time. So similarly, you're going to see a backlash. The smart thing to do that I would say to Jim and also to Ellen would be, get a stay and ask that these not happen, because then you'll have a chance to defeat the marriage amendment.
Jim Carroll is back, and I hope with a better line, Jim Carroll of Equality California. Jim?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. In 2000, the California voters voted pretty decisively against same-sex marriage. What do you think would happen this November if the constitutional amendment is on the ballot?
I think it's going to be defeated, and I think it's going to be defeated easily. I think that we've seen over these 8 years a strong and progressive movement of the people in California. We've seen the California legislature vote twice for marriage bills. And we saw in Massachusetts, as soon as people of the same sex started marrying there, that the polls moved strongly in support of same-sex marriage. So thank you, Randy, for your advice. But I think that we will get married.
Yeah, let me say
Ellen, something on that, Jim. Ellen Pontac, is this something that you're actively involved in? You and your partner, Shelley Bales, are quite well known in Davis, working on various gay and lesbian rights issues. Have you already forgotten about the Supreme Court ruling and started working on the constitutional amendment?
Well, I really think that there's no question that if the constitutional amendment makes it to the ballot, it will be defeated, because by then Californians will have seen so many same-sex couples marry, realize that the sky hasn't fallen in, realize that there are just a lot more happy and fulfilled people in our state. I can't imagine that people will actually vote to take away our marriages. I would like to give Randy some advice, however.
Okay.
I think that the best thing that he could do would be, if he really wants to do the Christian thing, to take all the money that they plan to use to pass this amendment to write discrimination into the Constitution, take that money and give it to our California schools, because that's where it's needed.
Okay, Randy?
If I could respond to that.
Please.
Children are already being sexually indoctrinated, Ellen, because of they're being taught about all sorts of sexual lifestyles due to bills that you and Jim support.
Can we stay away from schools? This is a whole different issue, and yeah, we're running out of time. So with all due respect to both of you, I have a suspicion that we could be on that for the rest of the program. Ellen, just briefly, where will you and Shelley go if you do to get married? Will you go back to San Francisco?
Oh, no. I'm a native Californian, and I live in Yolo County, and that's where I want to be married. Always have.
Okay. Craig DeLuz, final words, thoughts from you on this.
You know, I will tell you that, you know, there is no more divisive measure that actually passed so overwhelmingly amongst so many different groups: blacks, whites, Latinos, Asians, Northern Californians, Southern Californians, all voted to keep marriage between a man and a woman. And the most recent polls that have been done continue to support that. The most frustrating thing about all of this is that the people have never voted to approve same-sex marriage. And what I will say is that come the fall, the voters will have the opportunity to have their say, and I am confident that they're going to vote to keep marriage between a man and a woman.
And we'll wrap this up with you, Larry Levine. Is there any recourse beyond the California Supreme Court? Is there anything that people who oppose the ruling can do? Can it be appealed anywhere, or is this the final word?
The decision was based on the California Constitution, so the California High Court gets the last word on this. But if, in the unlikely event, in my opinion, if the initiative were to pass, that will spawn a whole new round of litigation, and the Supreme Court may have the occasion to speak again as to that issue.
Okay. Well, I have a hunch we'll be back to this topic at some point in the future. In the meantime, thank you all very much. In our studio, Larry Levine, law professor at McGeorge School of Law, and Craig Deleuze, he's a husband and father of two who's opposed to same-sex marriage. On the phone, Ellen Pontac in Davis. She and her partner, Shelley Bales, were married in San Francisco for a short time in 2004. And Jim Carroll, Managing Director of Equality California, and Randy Thomason, President of the Campaign for Children and Families. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Amigos de las Americas. It's a nonprofit that sends young people to volunteer on community projects in Latin America. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A campaign to recall State Senator Jeff Denham has been called off by one of its leaders, yet it remains on the June primary ballot. On the next Insight, we'll talk about the recall with some of the key players involved. Also, what might happen to Alzheimer's patients if funding for caregivers is cut? And you'll meet conductor Paul Perry. This is his last year as Artistic Director of Music in the Mountains. That's Insight next Tuesday. Some Sacramento area high school students head off to Latin America this summer to volunteer their time on community projects. They're with a group called Amigos de las Americas. It organizes trips like this every year. The two students who are with us are Jared Johnson, a junior at Davis High School, and Aaron Riley, a senior at Christian Brothers High School. They're both going to Nicaragua this year. This is Jared's first year and Aaron's second year. Jared, Aaron, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Okay, and also with us, Todd Simmons, he's the founder, the training director of the local chapter, the Sacramento Davis chapter of Amigos de las Americas. He's been on quite a few trips over the last few years. Todd, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Aaron, this is your second time doing it this year. So I guess it worked last year.
Yes, it worked. Yeah.
Tell us what you did last year and where you went.
Last year I was actually in Nicaragua. I lived in a community of about 950 people, a rural community. It was me and one partner who I'd met only a couple days before getting there, getting to the community. We lived with a host family. We taught classes in the school. We taught classes about dental hygiene, nutrition, environmental consciousness, things like that.
What qualified you to teach about dental hygiene?
Well, we have lots of training before we leave, and that's how we learn how to conduct a class and things like that. So,
what kind of people were you teaching? Young children?
Young children. They were from about, I'd say, 6 years old to 12 years old.
Wow. So that was Nicaragua last year.
Yes.
Where about? In a remote area?
Yeah, it was about 2 hours away from the city of Granada.
It must be quite a deal to get there.
Yes, yeah. We fly from Sacramento to Houston to Miami, then we go to Managua, and then we take a bus to Granada, and then we went in the back of a pickup truck to our rural community. So,
and how long were you doing that?
I was there for 8 weeks.
8 weeks, my goodness, that's quite a chunk of your summer doing it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And how did you feel at the end of it? Were you looking forward to doing it again?
Oh boy, at the end, yeah, I definitely wanted to come back. I was really excited to get back to Sacramento and talk about my experiences with the other volunteers I'd trained with. And I was excited. Yeah, I was glad to come back and tell people about it.
Mm. Aaron, Jared, this is your first year.
Yep, that's right.
You're going to Nicaragua.
Yeah, I'm going to Nicaragua.
Is it the same place?
It's the same region. Not the same community, but the same region.
And what will you be doing?
I'm pretty much open to whatever they want to do, basically. And, you know, I have classes apparently set up for me there. So I can help teach about whatever it is, dental hygiene or whatever I'm going to be doing. And I'm also going to be open to whatever the community wants to do with the funds that we have. And but my main goal is just to meet people and learn about their culture.
And will that be for 8 weeks as well?
Yeah, 8 weeks.
And you haven't done this before. How do you feel about it?
I am frightened when I think about it sometimes. Because, I mean, you know, growing up, I'm a little ill-traveled, especially in, you know, countries that speak other languages. So,
Where have you been before?
Last summer I went to Europe and stayed in the UK. So I've been to Mexico when I was really little, and that's it. So I have taken a few years of Spanish class. So,
how good is your Spanish?
Terrible.
Don't you need to be fluent in Spanish to teach?
My Spanish is going to be a crutch. I mean, is going to hold me back. That's for sure. But I think I'll be able to work through that with just my expression and how I move and how I act. And I think also I'll be with a partner. So if I really have to say something, you know, I can work through it, and I'll have my little dictionary with me too. But I really hope, I think my Spanish will really tune up too really quickly while I'm there.
And do you know where you're going to be staying, who you'll be staying with?
I don't know who I'm going to be staying with. I just know I'll be in Nicaragua in the Granada-Rivas region. Granada-Rivas.
Aaron, tell us about the people you stayed with last year.
Oh, gosh, the people we stayed with. My partner and I stayed with a host family. It was we had a host mom and a host dad, and we had a baby host brother who was about 6 months old. And we slept in their spare room. We spent a lot of time with our host mom. We cooked with her. We helped her clean house and things like that. Our host dad actually worked in the city of Granada, so he was gone a couple days at a time. And we spent a lot of time bonding with our host family. It was fun.
How was your Spanish at the beginning of the trip?
Oh, well, I was nervous about it, but at the same time, kind of enthusiastic, anxious to push through whatever language barrier there would be. You know, I got a lot of things wrong at first. There's a lot of really funny misunderstandings, but
So you were not fluent in Spanish when you started teaching your classes?
No, I had 3 years of high school Spanish.
And did the kids you were teaching, did they manage to figure out what you were telling them?
Yeah, it was actually, in my experience, it was a lot easier to talk with the kids. They're much more eager to try and understand what you're saying and help, you know, me understand what they were saying and things like that.
Yeah. Jared, how do your parents feel about you doing this for the first time?
Oh, my parents. Luckily for me, my parents are very open to these kind of things. But they said they're going to miss me quite a bit. And, you know, the contact is it's hard to stay in contact with them while I'm there. Mail takes a while. So they said they're going to miss me, and they're going to miss the sounds coming through my house of music and everything.
Sure. Aaron, did you have to do a job in your parents to your family to so that you could do it the first time?
Not the first time. I didn't. My parents were... Luckily, they, you know, paid for my trip, and I did a lot of fundraising also. This year, I had to get a job to go the second time, yeah.
And why do you do it?
Why do I do it? Well, I remember hearing a presentation at my school when I was, I think, 15, and I knew I wanted to do it as soon as I was old enough, just because, like Jared said, I was ill-traveled too, and I wanted to get out there and see what the rest of the world was like, and I did it, and now I'm hooked, you know.
But there are easier ways to travel the world without having to work.
I suppose so. I suppose you're right. I guess I just wanted to travel not as a tourist, you know, travel and really get to know the people and what they're like and have them see what I'm like, you know.
Sort of and like, Jared, yeah.
Yeah, sort of like, you know, looking at a picture of a painting or being in the painting, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like when I've traveled, you know, just anywhere, it's like I don't feel really engaged with the people I talk to, and I feel like I'm just watching things going on. But I feel like for me, this is the perfect place to give me a purpose to be somewhere. You know, I'm there and they know I'm there and I'm living with them. And so I'm one with them, really.
We're talking about Amigos de las Americas. It's a nonprofit that sends young people to work on community projects in Latin America. Aaron Riley and Jared Johnson are going off this summer. For Aaron, it's her second trip. Todd Simmons, what kind of people are you looking for? Do you filter out some people because they're not up to doing something like this?
Not necessarily. I mean, they pretty much filter themselves out, which is a very intensive program to go through. We start in October. We go through orientations, interviews. We really let them know what it takes to be a volunteer. And there's quite a bit of fundraising and time commitment that they do need to devote to the program prior to going. We do have a 10-month-long training period.
10 months long.
8 month. Recruiting included would be the 10 month, but it's an eight month long training period that we do.
Are you teaching them?
Anywhere from multicultural understanding, how to actually live in a community that's not their own, how to develop a lesson plan, or how to put together workshops with the community. And a majority of it, again, is safety with the volunteers and making sure that they're doing the best that they can to keep themselves safe in Latin America.
you've been to several countries in the last few years doing this work as a volunteer and as now as training director. What's your fondest memory of your various trips?
Fondest memory? I would
or
have
craziest
to
craziest or whatever. Looks craziest like it might be the same one. I don't know.
Craziest we might have to say for another time. But as far as fondest, I'd have to say it was a pretty big movie moment in that I had just spent 8 weeks in a small community up in Panama, up in the mountains of Coclay, Panama. And the community and the three volunteers, including myself, that were there, thought that we had grown a pretty good bond with the community and with the Hoven as the youth of the community. And as we were leaving, and we were picked up by a van, a group of the young men actually followed us out on bikes. And it was kind of an interesting little cap to the end of the project.
What about you, Aaron, when you were in Nicaragua last year? Any memories that always come to your mind?
Yeah, I'd have to say, kind of like Todd, that my fondest memory is working with the youth group there. They had a somewhat established youth group when we got there, and we had meetings every Tuesday at 5. But as we were the week, like I think our last meeting, they said, you know, before you guys came, hardly anybody came to these meetings. And that really meant a lot to us, because I think that we really solidified their group. And just the fact that we were there, they were excited to come, and that got them inspired, and that made me happy, yeah.
Todd, I can easily see how this is a great experience for young people in the United States, but how do you know that it's actually doing much good in Nicaragua and Mexico and all the other countries you work in?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it really shows when communities are actually requesting volunteers to come back. We also have a tool that we use called participatory evaluations, and at the end of every summer, we sit down with the communities, with and without the volunteers, and we really try to get a good idea of whether or not we actually did something in those communities. And yeah, I think it really shows in the community's faces and really talking to them.
Who pays for all this? Is it the young people mainly?
We are actually, the chapter itself is 100% funded by the volunteers. There's a significant portion that is out of pocket, but a majority of it is actually paid through the fundraising efforts that we do. And we sell coffee and olive oil and pecans. And we actually do a letter writing campaign.
Jared, what are you hoping to learn on this trip, if anything?
Well, I'm hoping to learn a lot about the community I'm staying in, the culture, I mean, for sure. But I think I want to learn how to engage myself with people who I would be uncomfortable talking to. I think I'm going to learn a lot of social skills, especially in other cultures, you know, how to be open to their ideas and then also be open to, you know, instead of watching them do their thing, go up there and do their thing with them, you know. I'm hoping to learn how to engage myself, and I think I'll take that skill with me wherever I go in the future.
And Aaron, what would you say you learned last year in Nicaragua, your 8 weeks there?
I think the greatest thing I learned was when I came back, I had this great sense of potential and really renewed faith in the youth of America that we can do such great things. But looking back, it seems like a dream, the things I did, and I guess I just came back with such confidence in what I can do and what other people like me could do.
And finally, Todd, how many young people in this area, in the Sacramento-Davis area, are doing this summer?
This summer we have 19 actually going from the Sacramento-Davis area.
My goodness. Well, Aaron Riley and Jared Johnson, best wishes for your work this summer.
Thank you. Sounds like
it's going to be exciting and interesting.
Thank you.
Yes, thanks.
And Todd Simmons, also thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for your interest. Thank you very much.
Todd Simmons is the founder and training director of the Sacramento-Davis chapter of Amigos de las Americas. Aaron Riley is a senior at Christian Brothers High School. Jared Johnson, a junior at Davis High School. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, Dead Lucky. It's a memoir of being left for dead near the top of Mount Everest. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up this afternoon from KXJZ News, presidential candidate John McCain in Stockton. Plus, new fundraising figures in the Sacramento mayor's race. Those stories are later today on All Things Considered. And tomorrow on Morning Edition, the results of a poll on the Sacramento mayor's race commissioned by KXJZ News and the Sacramento Bee. Climbing Mount Everest and getting back down safe and sound is a big achievement in itself. But what if you had been left for dead near the summit without all your survival gear and still made it down? That's the amazing story of Lincoln Hall, the veteran Australian mountain climber and author. His memoir, new memoir just published, is called Dead Lucky. He's in Sacramento today. Lincoln Hall, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
Before you got into trouble on Everest, you did reach the summit. How did you feel then? Did you have any reason to think there was trouble ahead for you?
Well, I had no reason to think there. Well, I knew there was trouble available. I knew that getting to the summit of a mountain is only getting halfway. And I knew that whenever you get to the summit, it means you're pretty tired because you've climbed this huge mountain. So, yeah, but I didn't know that anything about the dreadful things that would happen.
How was the weather at that point?
The weather was perfect. It was a fabulous day. There was a very low, well, it wasn't that low, I suppose, but 6,000 or 7,000 feet below the summit was a cotton wool carpet of cloud, which made Everest feel even bigger than it was, looking down, you know, with those clouds so far below. Just the slightest touch of wind and this amazing panorama all around.
And you felt tired, of course, because you'd climbed Everest, but did you feel more tired than you expected?
Well, no. I guess when you're climbing, you're not really so much analyzing. Well, you analyze what you need to, so you're just paying attention to what you have to do, and sort of warning lights go on if it's not quite going according to plan. So I was certainly alert, but there was nothing to say that anything was going to go wrong.
Lincoln Hall is author of Dead Lucky, Life After Death on Mount Everest. You weren't that far down from the summit when things went wrong for you.
Well, yeah, only 100 feet or so, really. I mean, it's quite a gradual descent along the final summit ridge, and then there's this great big snow slope, which is actually very easy to descend. It's probably the easiest part of the whole descent, actually, apart from the extreme altitude making it harder. But, yeah, I just felt really tired, and I wasn't all that surprised, because I just knew that that's what happens. But then it got to the point where the tiredness was overwhelming, and I just ended up lying in the snow.
Why did it happen to you? I mean, you're a veteran climber.
Well, the why I still don't understand, but I do know what happened. And what happened was that I was stricken with cerebral edema. And cerebral edema is where you get fluid retention within your skull. And, of course, your skull is a solid item. And
no room for maneuver.
No room for maneuver. So what happens is your brain gets squashed and the top of your spinal column as well. And basically that sends you crazy, makes you delirious and kills you. And I actually know what it's like because I've rescued someone with bad cerebral edema. And he was aggressively uncooperative. We had to sort of carry him like a drunk person. Then he just collapsed in the snow and muttered nonsense. And that's how I was. But the thing is, I felt very, very tired, and then suddenly I get the edema hits, and then I get all this energy from somewhere, and I want to I try to go back up the mountain, I try to jump off the east face, I keep pulling my oxygen mask off my face, the Sherpas are putting it back on, so they're struggling with me, and so it felt like they had no energy. I mean, I don't remember this part where I was doing all these crazy things, but but that was the really dangerous thing, that I was wasting all that energy, and that was why I wasn't able to descend the whole way.
And then you went unconscious. What did the Sherpas do? We've heard these stories about people being left behind on Everest.
I mean, that's a whole different question, because I guess the big factor there that's not understood at sea level is that you know, above 26,000 feet is what's called the death zone, and it's not just a journalist's sort of melodramatic name. It really is the death zone. I mean, even when you're in good shape, you're very aware that you have a very tenuous grasp on life. So when things did go wrong for me, I wasn't able to analyze what was going on. I didn't realize I was getting cerebral edema because I didn't have the classic symptoms, which are a big headache across your brow and double vision. I didn't get that. But by the time, so there was no opportunity to treat my illness because we didn't realize what it was.
And so the Sherpas at some point concluded that you were either dead or so close to being dead that it was going to happen.
Well, yes, essentially, yes. I mean, with their help, we got down to 28,000 feet. That we should have achieved that in an hour and a half or 2 hours. It took about 9 hours.
My guest is the climber Lincoln Hall. His new memoir is called Dead Lucky. He was once left for dead on Mount Everest. Word spread of your demise.
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the good things and I suppose the bad things about modern technology is that there are people with sat phones and laptops at base camp and they send out news. And so the word came down by radio very quickly. The Sherpas were in immediate communication with the expedition leader when things started to go wrong and when no signs of life were obvious from me, and they looked pretty hard for them. I think they desperately wanted to find signs of life, but couldn't do it. Anyway, they stayed with me for 2 hours after that until the expedition leader ordered them to descend in order to save themselves. And by that stage, it was 7 o'clock in the evening at 28,000 feet.
You somehow woke up the next morning.
Well, yes. I mean, waking up, it's a bit of a complex scenario about being left
for
dead.
Not an everyday waking up.
Yeah, you don't sort of wake up from death usually, except in horror movies. And I guess this was sort of a horror movie because I did have this series of hallucinations, which ultimately, so there was obviously some sort of spark of life in there.
You remember the hallucinations?
I do remember the hallucinations very vividly, actually, and they all had a sense of hope. And I was in different situations, different places, but there was a sense of hope in all of them. And there was also the message that was coming through my severely disabled brain was that I needed to just sit there and wait. And
moving was not much of an option.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess when I did come to in the middle of the night, it was pitch black. It was snowing, so I couldn't. It was very hard to get any sort of orientation. When I felt around for my pack, I couldn't feel anything. That's because my fingers were already frozen. I knew I was on the lip of a precipice because I could feel this huge cold updraft. So I knew that I couldn't move at all because I didn't know if I was going to slip off.
It must be an unimaginably lonely feeling to be left for dead up in the dark on Mount Everest without your gear.
Well, I suppose so, but I quickly assessed that was the case. But I wasn't going to cry about it because I was too busy trying to. Well, I mean, I thought I was going to die. There was no doubt about that. The hypothermia, the hypoxia,
Where was the cavalry going to come from?
Well, there was no cavalry, and the cavalry had left, and then they'd taken my pack, which had extra some fluid in there, some extra warm clothing, and so I really had nothing. The only thing I had was my feeble mind and my body that was starting to freeze around the edges.
Well, if you thought you were going to die, given where you were, how did you occupy your time?
Well, I always think it's a good idea to occupy your time meaningfully, and I realized that what I had to do was somehow stay awake through the night. And I knew that would be an incredibly difficult thing to do. And I decided that I would bring some of the skill of focus that I had learnt through the focus that you need when climbing, but also through years of meditation. I didn't want to go into a meditative state, but I used that focus that you need to be able to meditate steadily. I applied that focus to my physical body, being aware of my physical body. But then I found it wasn't working. I found that my mind was starting to drift off. So what I did was I started rocking, putting my hands in my armpit and rocking from side to side. And And then that got a little bit hypnotic. So then I went rocked forwards and backwards. Then I would start going, sort of revolving, just moving my body in a slight circular motion clockwise. And then once that started to become hypnotic, I'd go the other way. And I realized that this was the only way I was going to get through the night, was by keeping my mind engaged on my body.
And then a rescue party arrived. Did you trust what you were seeing?
Well, I did, because I was so focused on just making that movement. I had pretty well, my mind was empty of what had gone behind, what had happened in those preceding hours. And even the future I wasn't focusing on, because I knew if I thought about anything other than what I was doing, I would lose my focus. And I knew there was this life force telling me that you can't use your focus on what you're doing. So when those guys arrived, and that was a team of four climbers led by American Dan Mazur, when they arrived, I greeted them with the words, "I imagine you're surprised to see me here." And of course, they were totally shocked, because they'd been told to expect my body.
Wow.
And the reason I think that I gave that sort of fairly flippant but eloquent answer, remark, was because I wasn't clued into the horrible situation that I was in, and the almost inescapable death that seemed to be facing me. I was just hanging in there doing my, here I am in this moment. Oh, here you are. Hi. So, but it really flummoxed them. There's no doubt about that.
Lincoln Hall's memoir is Dead Lucky, Life After Death on Mount Everest. Now, getting you down was a big thing in itself. I can't help but be struck by the pictures inside the book, and one of them is on the cover of you looking quite disheveled and looking at these black fingertips. And in the book, inside the book, there's a picture of your black toes. That's the frostbite, I guess.
Yes, that's the frostbite, yes. So I no longer have those bits of my digits are no longer there.
Must be a disturbing sight to look at your body turning black.
You don't see it turn black. I mean, for the first maybe 10 or 12 hours, it's just has a sort of waxy, looks like a sort of candly color, and it feels like you've got wooden fingers, and then it hurts. It hurts. Usually, I've had frostbite before, and it really hurts when it thaws out. But this time, by the time it thawed out, I wasn't thinking about pain. I was just thinking about getting down the mountain.
Have you gone back to climbing?
Oh, well, I've actually hoping to do some rock climbing over this Memorial weekend in Santa Fe with one of my friends from Everest. Rock climbing's a very different thing, though. My surgeon, I've got the tips missing from all of my fingers, and my surgeon actually recommends climbing as a good thing to be doing. I have no plans to go back into the high mountains at this point.
Because you physically can't do it, or because mentally or emotionally you don't want to do it?
Well, I guess physically, I know from past frostbite that I got 30 years ago that it, and I know from being in Banff last November that when it's really cold, my hands hurt. So that's a sort of that aspect. But also, I guess the real reason I wouldn't want to go up to those extreme heights is because I don't know why that cerebral edema hit me. I'm actually a very safe climber. I've turned back from near the summit of Everest before. I've turned back from other climbs for safety reasons. And this time it came out of nowhere. And I don't want to. I mean, the first premise of being a climber is that you go up and you bring yourself up and you bring yourself down. You don't put other people's lives at risk.
Sure.
And so I'm not prepared to go and explore that.
Yes. And finally, and apropos of nothing, the foreword to your book is written by Lachlan Murdoch. Is that the Lachlan Murdoch who's the son of Rupert Murdoch?
That's right. Yes, it is. And yeah.
He's a climber.
He is a climber, yes. Not that he gets all that much time to do it these days.
I see. Lincoln Hall is author of Dead Lucky, Life After Death on Mount Everest. He speaks this evening at 6 o'clock in Sacramento at the Downtown Library Galleria. Lincoln Hall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, the growing interest in green vacations. Plus, Swiss bank UBS holds a yard sale of sorts. It's selling more than $15 billion of wobbly mortgage-backed securities at a 30% discount. The stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producers were Donna Lee, Jason Tredoe, and Sochi Lopez. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Today on the board, Evan Matzler. Our interim producer, Robin Souza. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.